Hello, and welcome to the Software Stories podcast from Venturi's Voice. I'm your host, Andy Davis. In this show, I'll be chatting to software experts from all sectors about their careers in tech. The show aims to bring you insights, anecdotes, and stories from like-minded professionals that you can learn from and apply to your own career. If you like the show and you want to hear more from us, you can follow us via SoundCloud, iTunes, or Spotify, or join us on Slack. Thank you, and enjoy the show. So we've got Ronald Pomper here. He's the VP of Product at Faceit. Absolute pleasure to have you on the show, Ronald.
Thank you very much for having me.
No problem. Thanks so much for doing this. Very much looking forward to the conversation. It's actually been a while since we've had anyone from Product on the show, and I've actually been really desperate to get someone on the show because, as you'll soon find out, I'm about to bombard you with a million questions about the role. So please bear with me. Tell me to slow down if necessary as well. But I am very much excited to have you on the show. For context for everyone listening, would you mind just kind of giving us a bit of a brief overview of sort of your background and experiences today, if you wouldn't mind?
So a little bit about myself is I'm a VP of Product at Faceit, which is a leading online gaming platform for people to want to play video games in a competitive setting. And what we do is bring consumers onto the platform to play the video games, but then we also integrate with the games seamlessly, so you have a very good experience end-to-end, as well as we're trying to empower the community to build experiences around the games. So if you're interested in a game, a particular game, you might want to use our tools to build a tournament or even a community.
Awesome. So what were some of the prior experiences then? I know, obviously, I think beforehand you were at Spotify. Did you kind of start your career out in product? Because to me, kind of product is similar to, I suppose, the conversations that I've had with data engineers and people like that, is that there doesn't seem to necessarily be like a linear kind of route to becoming, you know, a product manager. It always seems to be quite varied, which I think is good, of course. It's nice to have varied perspectives. But what was your particular route? Was it something that you always kind of had your mindset on from the beginning?
Truthfully, I actually wanted to work in the video game industry, but I got recruited by Spotify in the early days. Mm-hmm. I started off as a bit of a project management role, but it eventually kind of led into the product path that I'm on right now. Like you said, it's not necessarily something that kind of you educate. You can't go to university and say, hey, I want to become a product manager. It's something that comes with difference of experiences, and you kind of put on a lot of hats and you try to become a generic problem solver in a sense.
Yeah. Do you find that I've had experiences, for instance, with product managers who, you know, aren't technical whatsoever. And then of course there's product managers that are very technical. There's a big scope of that. Do you think that there's still, although it is come in such a varied role, that you think there should be some sort of prerequisites in a sense to actually be able to come in and be a product manager? What's your kind of opinion on that?
I think it depends on what type of product you're building. If you're building something more of an experience UX type of thing, and maybe you're like, if you're not interfacing with a lot of engineers, then it's not necessarily a necessity. But I think, though, like, because usually you come into the route of working together closely with engineers, it does help having a bit of a technical background or experience to understand and, you know, understand what you're talking about, and even being able to explain yourself or get the feedback and kind of understand what's going on. So yeah, I think it depends on what the product is, but in my experience, it's been very helpful to have a bit of a technological background.
Do you kind of, what's the time split been then from your kind of experience, you know, between, you know, actually being hands-on, you know, the management side of it, you know, I guess it's a bit of project management in there as well. What is the kind of split, I suppose, from your experience been?
I mean, my day-to-day is talking to engineers quite a lot. So I would say majority of my time is talking about technical aspects of the product. But it is kind of trying to translate that to something that is understandable to our consumers, our stakeholders, and so on. So it's kind of becoming the person to glue everything together, you know.
Absolutely. And, you know, obviously, I think Spotify, not to mention Spotify too much, but obviously they, you know, are kind of renowned for having this unique kind of approach to building. I think, I can't remember what they call it now, but you know, it's a
Spotify model, or
yeah. Well, I think they actually call it the Spotify model, don't they?
Yeah.
So I assume that was there from sort of when you were there as well, and how did you kind of find that experience? And have you, obviously, was it something that was a great to learn, or was it just so confined? I mean, we are seeing obviously lots of other businesses trying to emulate this model. Some successfully, some not so much. But what was that kind of experience like, and what were some of the kind of key learnings that perhaps you've taken and brought along with you to face it?
No, I think it's definitely an interesting topic, because I was there when it was kind of introduced and built and grown into the company. And I think the model, or you know, what we really learned from that was, you know, it's to adapt, learn as the environment changes, make the appropriate changes, and also, you know, the autonomy that you get within the team, so you can go and do a lot of things without having to have the, you know, the sign off or the blessing from the CEO and such. So I think I think this is where a lot of people trying to implement this model saying, okay, it's just, you know, you can't just read a blueprint and say, this is how you do it. It's, you know, you have to take in consideration of your culture in the company, how, what you're building, what you're doing, and, you know, you have to kind of adapt that. But then most of the takeaways from that time was, you know, adapt to the environment. Don't wait on bureaucracy and process, but rather, you know, work closely together on a problem and try to figure out that problem as fast as possible.
How you mentioned like the adaptive nature of it. So was it a perspective that it's sort of, this is what worked for them? You know, you're at Face It now, I'm sure there's or something slightly different that works for them. Was that the takeaway? Because the outward perspective is that they kind of came up with this great idea, you know, and were disciplined implementing it because of, you know, what their beliefs were in the way of working. But I guess the point I'm getting at is that you were alluding to the fact that it really was just about being adaptive and sort of agile in that respect. And was that really the case?
Absolutely. I mean, in the early days, you know, that the company was growing quite fast. So, we're trying to figure out how to make sure that you weren't blocked by process, you weren't blocked by unnecessary waste, right? And so that was kind of like the whole agile at scale movement. So it was something that was iterated through a lot of people at the company with agile coaches and stuff. And, you know, it worked. And, you know, some of the bits you can take that, and that's definitely something that I have taken to Face It, to make sure that, you know, some of the things that worked and how, you know, we create autonomy and remove the you know, the unnecessary process. Mm-hmm. That's definitely been something I've been implementing here. But, you know, it's you have to take it, you know, case by case, or you have to understand what works and what doesn't work. And that's really what the model was, first and foremost. It was just making sure that, oh, these things work, these don't. And, you know, remove the things that don't work and add the things that work. So it's not different from I would say any company that are trying to figure out how to ship faster, build you know, good ideas, experiment, and validate their products and such.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've seen it so many times where you kind of become. Well, you can kind of ironically do the complete opposite of what you're trying to do with this kind of, you know, agile, and let's just call it agile scrum kind of way of working, and the various adaptations that people have come up with from that. But, you know, the irony I tend to find is when it's done incorrectly, it actually just adds processes and almost more structure. And I think that that's when people come in with this kind of overcommitment. And I find the tech industry is interesting in that respect, that, you know, we're all sort of copying one another in so many respects, while at the same time trying to innovate in others. And I think that the innovation can typically kind of be synonymous with the technology. But actually, in my opinion, the companies that have been particularly innovative and remarkably successful are the ones who've, instead of focused, you know, all the innovation on the tech side and just kind of copy the people and the processes side, they're the ones who really look to innovate, if you want to call it that, on the people and processes side.
Honestly, I always go down to, it's down to the culture, right? It's the culture that you build in a company around the team that you're working closely with. And that's really, you know, you have to take it team by team or group by group. And that's where you really try to figure out what works best for the team. So it's not necessarily, I think, the process, like, you know, oh, you can go agile by the book, but I don't think it's gonna, you know, it's not gonna work if you have bad culture.
Yeah. Interesting. So the cultural one's an interesting one, isn't it? Because you know, if you come and work into a business, you know, you can't necessarily like change the culture. Maybe you can, but it's difficult to influence it, especially if it's a, you know, mid to larger size business. So do you think that's where the kind of the pod type system comes in, is that you can have, do you think it is healthy to have kind of cultures within a business, these sort of micro cultures?
I think it definitely works. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, I kind of related down to the military. You have, you know, the military, the process and everything, but then you build your own culture around the squad, right? And that's kind of where a lot of the time with Spotify was called squads, right? And not team, because you were kind of in the shit with your squad, right?
Right.
So I think it is building the, you know, a very specific culture around the group of people that are working with on a daily basis. And, you know, you rely on them, you trust them to make the right decisions, and, you know, you're failing with them as well. That happens, you know, and that is also the most important thing around the bigger culture, is that it's okay to fail. It's okay to test things and try out things, and hopefully they'll pan out. But if they don't, okay, let's go to the next one. It's worse to, you know, fail, but fail for a longer period. So you always talk about like fail fast, right? And it is the bigger culture. But then on a micro level, you know, you're there building a bonding with the team. So
I think that, you know, that kind of fail fast culture only works if, you know, there isn't layers upon layers of hierarchy, because I think if there is, and, you know, the perception is that the way to progress is through hierarchical order, then people aren't going to be as willing to take risks. You know, and I think that it goes kind of hand in hand, isn't it, really? I mean, that it is culture, but in a way, do you not think that it's also kind of driven by, you know, the structure and the process that has been, you know, designed from the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a set of tools that you get, right? When you work with the different agile frameworks, or, you know, the tools that you get on a daily basis to kind of map your tasks and your stories and stuff like that. I think again, it's more going down to the fact that you're building trust in the team and in the company itself, right? That you trust that you're trying to make the best decisions and the best solutions to the problem. But as we all know, you know, the world is very chaotic. You never know what might work 100%. Like, you can't, and, you know, if you take back to, you know, the model that was used in software development back in the days, like the waterfall model, how would you even know what's going to happen next 5 years in terms of the consumers and in terms of technology and such? So a lot of this is done, yeah, you know, you have a framework, you're saying it, try to build things iteratively and quickly and see, you know, how a change is validated as soon as possible, so that you know that you're moving in the right direction, the wrong direction. So That's the framework itself. But then, you know, it's the you were working with people, right? You can't just give them instructions and always expect that it's going to process it like a machine. It's about bringing people together, have the fun while doing it, and try and be curious. And yeah,
I want to take a little of a sidestep, I suppose, to the back onto some of the talk about the product side of things. Relatively speaking, it seems to me like it's a new role. And I think it's almost come at a time where it's almost been expected that developers, and engineers are almost expected to be much more commercially aware than perhaps they used to be. And mm-hmm. I feel as though that kind of product role almost came in at that time when we realized that actually, we do need, our developers to not just be, I suppose, coding away and building products and, not actually on the front line of understanding where value has been driven from. I think the good ones will have always probably had those instincts anyway. But the kind of progression of the product role, how far away am I from thinking that it almost seems as though it kind of has become what it is now relatively recently, and it's almost stemmed from, the commercial drivers that are now necessary for, developers and engineers?
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I don't think they're correlated at all, but it is just an evolution of, previously you had managers telling people what to do, and that might have worked, that someone had all the answers, to all the questions in the world, which is most unlikely. But I think the product manager role or the product owner role, in that sense, it grew up from the idea, okay, you have to have someone understand a little bit of the bigger vision and so on. But I do think it's expected by a lot of the team and engineers, designers, etc., to be closer to all the information. I mean, you're only as good as the information you have available to you, right? And I think that's where interesting solutions happen to the problems that you're trying to solve. If you're trying to have, you become a bottleneck if you have one person thinking about all the solutions to a problem and then just delegating that and trying to orchestrate it, I don't think that's efficient at all. I think it's coming together as a team and becoming very, very focused on the problem of what you're trying to solve.
So when you were, your engineering or, when you were developing, for you as a sense of fulfillment, was it important to you and or, say, for instance, has it always been important to the teams that have worked with you that they see the commercial success of their efforts? Is that a major driver now? Is that a great sense of fulfillment?
Yeah, I think, I mean, like my developing career was very short-lived, and it was when I was doing my own startup. Mm-hmm. So I think in that sense, I was actually so close to information that everything that was coming in, and we said, oh, we need to solve these problems, I could act on it, right? So it was me becoming more empowered to do the right decisions. But then, obviously as a company grows, you need to start having these roles that people that can go and talk to stakeholders, talk to consumers and so on. I do still expect that even if you are a developer, you're still expected to be able to have a sense of what the product is that you're building, and you should be able to use it and talk to the customers depending on who that is. I think the more information you have, the more context you have to something, the better output you're gonna have.
And now obviously moving towards the current role at Face It as well, where do you feel that you are getting the greatest sense of fulfillment from now in the work that you're doing?
I think great to be at a company like, again, a very fast growing company in the gaming business, which I've always been passionate about doing for a very long time. And like I said, we are implementing some things that are working very well in terms of agile methodologies and such. But again, it's building the culture that I'm very focused about right now. So that excites me a lot. And we are, we are an interesting company trying to solve a very cool problem, which is competitive esports gaming.
And you know, for people motivated to kind of learn more and get maybe a bit more of a taste for the culture, maybe even motivated to come and, you know, get involved in the mission, you know, what would you, what advice would you give? What kind of person are you, would you be looking for that you think would fit in if there is that kind of type of person?
I would describe our culture as, you know, we are hard workers. We love challenges in the space, and we're also a little bit silly. So, I think, if you have some of the kind of foundational skills that we're looking for in terms of engineering or design or, business management, product management, you know, we want to hear that. And, you know, if you're playing video games and you think it's, you know, interesting to see what's happening in the esports segment of gaming, hey, you know, throw us a letter. We're always interested to find new talent.
Awesome. Is there a website or anywhere where they can go to kind of learn more or see what roles are open and such?
Yeah, so you could definitely go to corporate.faceit.com. That's where our job postings are visible for anyone, and you can also read a little bit more about the company, what we do, and such.
Yeah, and I suppose last question from me before we shut it down here is just what's, you know, coming up in the future that perhaps you're kind of most excited about. I know you mentioned culture, but is there anything else that's happening over at Faceit that, you know, you particularly that you can talk about? Of course, before, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most exciting thing is that we're really investing a lot in data and machine learning now. So we are definitely doubling down on engineers in that area. So we're trying to figure out, you know, how do we solve some of the problems that we have on the platform today or even in gaming in general. One thing I can talk about is toxicity. It's the number one problem we have, or you know, I think games have in general, is a lot of people, you know, being toxic to others while playing games. And we're trying to find different ways and different data models to predict and even, you know, understand that, okay, that person might not or should be restricted in using some of the features, or should be limited to playing on the platform. So it's really exciting to jump into that type of area in a small business that we have.
Yeah, and it's a great problem to solve, of course. So there's it's nice to have that, I suppose, that social factor as well involved in it. Ronald, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate. Thank you so much for taking the time. Really enjoyed the chat. Hopefully we can catch up and do it again soon.
Thanks, Andy. It was awesome to talk about this. Cool.
Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturers Voice Slack group. See you next time. Thank you.